Thanks, Tom and Ann, for inviting me to speak this morning about some of the approaches of potentially getting to know in the acute care setting. My name is David Zonies. I have no disclosures. I'm a trauma surgeon. I do a trauma acute care and emergency general surgery. So this is the brief agenda over the next 15 minutes, or just to talk about some of the considerations, talk about if some of the tools that currently exist, some of those things that were just briefly talked about at the introduction about some of the various calculators that are out there that may just help sort of inform your approach to seeing the patient prior to coming to a conclusion, and then maybe some ways forward. So this was presented by Ron Mayer, our current president, during the AAST, the American Association for the Surgery of Trauma lecture, named lecture 2 years ago. And this is what the vision may be for those of us in the room who do acute care surgery, and that is the typical three pillars of trauma, emergency surgery, and critical care, but really to add this fourth pillar, which is palliative care. And I think we do it on a pretty routine basis, many of us do, but we just don't call it that. And I think that this is what ultimately the future of this specialty will evolve into. And so that's really the framework that I'm gonna use to talk about seeing the patient. For those of you, I'm not sure how many of you have seen this, this is the Rogers innovation curve. So in when you look at innovation across the spectrum, there's things that move from, you know, the early innovators to the early adopters to the majority, and then ultimately the laggards who ultimately come along because they have to because of requirements. The question is where are we when it comes to having these discussions as a field? And I would argue that I think we're somewhere in the early adopters, probably in that first 10 to 13% is where we are as a field right now. And it's continuing to grow. But we have clearly a fair amount to get the rest of the field of surgery on board. If you just look at this as an example, this is consistent whether it's in healthcare, across business. This is what it looked like when we were introducing smartphones. So back in 2004 or 5, there were the innovators. And then around 2007 is when the iPhone came out, right? And so that was the first 10 to 15%. And now if you look today, and you raise your hand, I'm sure if I took a poll in here right now, who does not have an have a smartphone, it's probably less than 1 or 2%. And I think that is ultimately the approach that we need to take is as we continue to innovate and introduce these ideas of palliation as part of our practice, that we will ultimately move from this innovation to the vast majority. So let's take an example. You get a phone call at 1 o'clock in the morning from the medical intensive care unit. It's an 83-year-old woman who's been admitted with abdominal pain. She has a CT scan that shows evidence of metastatic disease, and it clearly looks like she's developing a malignant bowel obstruction. She has what looks like likely mets in her mesentery, her small bowel, her large bowel. You get the phone call because she has abdominal pain and she's suddenly gotten worse. What do we do? Well, obviously we're going to see the patient. And the issues that surround this, especially in the acute setting, because we all get these calls, is that 20% of patients over the age of 65 who undergo a major abdominal operation are going to likely die within the next 30 days. Right, so that's the reality of it. And those who do survive that operation may no longer be independent. If I told you she was living independently at home and now she comes in with this, you know likely what her trajectory is going to be. And that really should inform some of the decisions that we make. From just an economics perspective, a third of all Medicare beneficiaries will undergo a surgical procedure in the last year of their life. And when you look in multiple studies, most patients would prefer to avoid any complex treatment if they know that it will diminish their capacity or diminish their ability to preserve their functional status. So that is just the backdrop. Now, what's our role as a surgeon in this acute setting? Well, clearly, we're committed to the primacy of their welfare. It's part of our professionalism. We, as surgeons, are very comfortable with complex illness. We can place this acute illness in the context of their underlying disease. We understand both the indications and contraindications of offering an operation. And so I think that we are really in the best possible position to be having this conversation. And we routinely, certainly in my practice and probably many those of you who practice critical care, we routinely have complex patient dynamics, complex family dynamics that occur on a daily basis. So I think the surgeon's role is really critical here. well, how about the emergency patient? Well, I think in we would all probably agree that life preservation is our goal, but I think it's a life well lived. And most patients would clearly want to have their life saved if you asked, right? This is pretty common. So the question is does the benefit of what we're potentially going to offer them outweigh all of the risks and potential consequences? Now, is acute care something special? Is it different? Well, I think it is, and we're going to hear a whole separate talk about chronic illness and chronic surgical disease. But clearly, acute care, whether it's trauma or an emergency operation, certainly for trauma, it affects all ages. It goes across the spectrum. This is just not a problem of the elderly. It is sudden, it's unexpected, and in many cases, the prognosis is uncertain. We don't know what their trajectory is exactly going to be. But we can inform them on potentially quality of life after an operation, and oftentimes they may not be predicted just by their injury severity alone if it's, say, trauma. Now, the other problem that we have to deal with is the culture that many of us have been trained in, and that is the culture of cure. And historically, there has been very little training in palliation, in surgical training, and often it is that death is the enemy. Certainly in trauma care, death is always the enemy, and I will have these conversations with some of my colleagues where I'm maybe managing their critical illness of their patient. They've established a patient relationship, now they've had an acute change, and they just want to continue to go all the way until ultimately there are no other options, surgical options left, and perhaps that's not really the right thing to be doing. And I think the last piece is that it is rarely considered that quality of life is discussed at M&M. We often talk about technical complications and potentially what you would do differently the next time, but it's rare to hear the issues of quality of life surrounding that particular patient's disease process discussed in that format. So when thinking about whether to offer an operation or to say no to an operation, it's really to think to yourself, is this treatment in agreement with the aims that the patient really has? And that is it relieving their symptoms? Is it easing their pain? And is it providing improved quality of life to them? And if you can't meet that litmus test, I think you need to think about whether you're really offering them the appropriate therapy. And that all these interventions are really based on the ability to meet their stated goals, which is not necessarily the technical piece of curing the pathology, but actually meeting their goals of why they came in, which is typically relief of pain, relief of suffering, and improving their quality. So some of the barriers is still there's, I believe, a fear of taking away hope just by opening this conversation that potentially you're taking away the hope of a patient, which I think is a false argument. And that often, I think it may often be our problem, not the patient's problem. They have engaged with you for a consultation. The team have consulted you to see this patient, and I think they're expecting an honest response from you. And then finally, this expectation of buy-in, that if you're in for an operation and it goes south, are you in until the very end? And I think that certainly in the acute setting, there sometimes needs to be a reset. So what are some of the tools that we have? Dr. Miner mentioned a few of these. The first, the easy ones. Well, do they have an advanced directive? Is there something we can go back toward and see what their thoughts were, especially if it's hard for them to participate? Do you have particular legal requirements in your state, in your hospital? And what is going to be the role certainly of substituted judgment if the person you're seeing can't actually participate and they're so acutely ill and there's a contemplation of an operation? How will that be approached? Many states have an equivalent of this. I'm in Oregon, so we have the physician order for life-sustaining therapy, the PULSE form in Oregon. Many states have something like this. We are the darker pink are some of the more mature systems, but this continues to grow. And this is yet another document where we can oftentimes look at an order that's written, and this typically comes up if you look at a patient and you ask yourself sort of the surprise question, would it surprise me if this person were dead in a year? Right? And if the answer is wouldn't surprise me, then that's typically the patient, in the year or two, that this patient would potentially be offered filling out a PULSE form. And so in some cases, if they've identified that it's comfort measures only, this will really help inform some of the decision making to make sure that we're aligning potentially offering an operation with their stated goals. Now, it was mentioned, a lot of these calculators are based off of patients who go to the operating room, Dr. Miner said. I think this is still somewhat informative, at least to kind of give you a sense of where things are going based on their diagnosis. And the example I gave you, I just plugged her data in here, just so that you at least have a sense, or if it's the resident team that's seeing the patient initially, they have a sense of what it would look like if they do go to the operating room. And I think having some of this data is very useful, and I think it's useful for patients to be able to hear some of this. One of the other hats I wear is I run our ECMO program, and I actually use this tool because those patients are extraordinarily high risk of dying when we get a phone call for an intervention. And there are many calculators, again, they're very retrospective in nature, but I think these tools are really helpful to help us inform some of the decision making. So this is a very simple iPhone app where you can plug in their data and you have a sense of what their risk of dying is so that you have a reasonable conversation with the patient, with their family. If you, for those of you of any interest, even before you potentially call, the ELSO website now has a reporter where you can actually put in the ICD-9, you can put in the free text, and it'll pull every single patient who's ever been put on support based on that diagnosis and will tell you what how many have had that diagnosis and how many survived. It's really informative to use that tool. If it's a trauma patient, many of you may be familiar with this work, and I left the full reference there. I think it's really helpful is to look at the geriatric trauma outcome score. It's just another tool that you have in your armamentarium that can give you some starting point for a conversation if you have a family that is interested in data. And it's just basically based on their injury severity, their age, and whether they've had a transfusion, and can give you a percent risk of mortality. But I think the most important thing from tools aside is really to think about a structured way of having a conversation. This is Zara Cooper's work, who's in the back there. And this is just a structured way of having that conversation. I really would encourage all of you, if there's one take-home point, is to read this paper. It's a great structure of how to start that conversation and some key prompts on how to have those conversations. And this is just, again, breaks it down from talking about their prognosis that you know at the time and being able to inform them with really good data and with really your expert opinion, talk about their options. And I think probably the most important thing is that if you're going to decide not to offer an operation in this joint decision making, is that last piece there, which is support, which is, you know, we are still committed, regardless of the outcome, to take care of you, whether it is an operation or just supportive care. And I think that's really, I think, one of the most important things to close that loop with a patient. I misspoke. The second paper I'd recommend, if there's another you're going to read, is this technique here. And this is something that our own our institution is now beginning to adopt, which is the best case, worst case scenario. And the idea here is that, you know, you can present to a family and actually do this on a whiteboard or do it on a piece of paper. You know, have a conversation with the patient, with their family, if there's going to be an operation. This is, if everything goes absolutely perfectly, this is what your best case may look like. And that best case may be 2-3 weeks in the ICU, 2-3 weeks in a rehab facility or a skilled nursing facility, and maybe go home or maybe never be independent. Your worst case scenario may be 2-3 weeks in the ICU, pneumonia, a UTI, and ultimately dying in the ICU. And then you can actually put where you think they are, so best case, worst case, and where you think they are at that time. And then there can be a separate pathway, which is if we don't offer you an operation and we're still focusing on your comfort and your quality of life, this is what I think that best case may look like. This is what I think the worst case may look like. And this is where I think you are, or talking to their family, this is where I think your loved one will be, where they are today, and where I think they may be tomorrow. And this is just not a one-time event. You come back and see them because you're consulted on them, you see them the next day, and you run through the same thing again. This is where I think they are today. And so again, it sort of tells a story and it sets out a trajectory, and I think that families really find this very helpful. Just in the last few minutes here, many of you are probably familiar with the Choosing Wisely campaign. I went through this in the last day and looked at all the various Choosing Wisely do nots, right? So these are things you're not supposed to offer or not supposed to do because there's no good evidence to support it. Well, the American College of Surgeons has one. They have a top five, as does the American Association for Hospice and Palliative Medicine. But what's really lacking here, and these are pretty common things, but what's really lacking is this question about when potentially not to not offer an operation or not offer a surgery. And I think this is a wide open space where we really need to explore this, because we really need to evolve the field and probably improve on this choosing wisely. Now, there are some other societies, there's about 50 or 60 societies that have contributed to this document, and you can pull this down off of the web, of the, you know, making smart, reasonable decisions based on good evidence. Certainly, we don't have a lot of evidence in this field right now, but I think this is one area where we can contribute. So just to take us back to the innovation curve, where do I think surgeons, so if you look at the very top right there, that's palliative care services. If you're in a major hospital anywhere in the United States, you've got more than 80% of those hospitals have palliative care services. We've actually done really well in terms of innovation and evolution of palliative care for expert consultation. But we as surgeons, especially in this particular acute environment, I think we're still on the very, very far left side of that curve. And I believe just by the nature of the group that's here are probably part of those early adopters. But I think that we have got quite a ways to go until we get complete saturation, that this becomes just part of our standard surgical education. So I think in summary, I've tried to talk about some of those considerations, give you a few tools and some papers to look towards. And again, I think that the idea here is that the patient should live for as long as possible, as well as possible. Thanks.